from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, so proud, so very proud to be back in the old new Le Show Dome. You know, for during the war, we were shunted off to the new Le Show Dome. Of course, the old Le Show Dome is being massively refurbished. I didn't even know it was furbished in the first place, and now they refurbish it, so imagine my surprise. But we're in the old new Le Show Dome, so I almost know how things work. And speaking of which, it's time for the new Iraq. That's right, the old new Iraq didn't work quite, well, it didn't work at all. General Jay Garner's Iraq. That was the first new Iraq. That was the one where all the gas lines, not lines of gasoline, lines for gasoline. Remember the 70s? It's like that over there. No electricity in the hospitals. Everything looted. That was the new Iraq. Now comes the new Iraq. We're almost American enough to say new and improved, but not quite. Anyway, Jay Garner has been replaced by a civilian, Paul Bremer, and everything's going to be fine, ladies and gentlemen, just as soon as we catch up. Because, you see, it turns out that much like 9/11, nobody planned for this. Nobody imagined that we would have to do this stuff. Apparently, because we're not doing it. If we did plan for it, the plans were, shall we say, hazy. But more about that moments from now, because it's Mother's Day. Hello, welcome to the show.
Motherly love. Motherly love. Forget about the brotherly and otherly love. Motherly love is just a thing for you. If you know your mother's gonna love you till you don't know what to do. The mother's got love that'll drive you mad. They're raving about the way we do. No need to feel lonely, no need to feel sad. If we ever get a hold on you, what you need is motherly love.
Come on, get it now.
Motherly love. Forget about the brotherly and otherly love. Motherly love is just a thing for you. You know your mother's gonna love you till you don't know what to do. Nature's been good to this here band. Don't ever think we're shy. Send us up some little groupies and we'll take their hands and rock them till they sweat and cry. What you need is motherly love.
Get it now.
Motherly love. Forget about the brotherly and otherly love. Motherly love is just a thing for you. You know your mother's gonna love you till you don't know what to do. We can love you till you have a heart attack. You best believe that's true. We'll bite your neck and scratch your back till you don't know what to do. What you need is motherly love. Motherly love. Forget about the brotherly and otherly love. Motherly love is just a thing for you. You know your mother's gonna love you till you don't know what to do.
You know I got a little motherly love for you, babe. Yeah. You know I got a little motherly love for you, honey. Yeah. You know it doesn't bother me at all that you're only 18 years old. Cause I got a little motherly love for you, babe.
Let it be soon, This is real. It's a fact. I'll always belong only to you. Each day I'll be living to make sure I'm giving you
from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to the show. Here, right here. Look, oh, I dropped it.
I got it. It's just down here. I'm not going to fall.
What the hell? It's radio. Here, ladies and gentlemen, apropos of did we plan for the thing. Several people involved in the process have said Jay Garner, the former head of the New Iraq, and his staff, as well as his superiors at the Pentagon, did not properly plan for the task, whether it's repairing damage suffered during the war or restarting government ministries and forming an Iraqi-led interim administration. Didn't plan for that. We knew we were going to win. We. The United States knew it was going to win and apparently didn't plan for winning. Or what do you do after you win? In Baghdad, many neighborhoods still lack electricity and running water. Heaps of garbage line the streets. Sounds like New York. And most shops remain closed because merchants are afraid of looters. There are large parts of the city that are in really bad shape, says a senior official. The city's better than it was 3 weeks ago, but it still has a long way to go. Again, sounds like New York. We got a plan. We got to make some plans, ladies and gentlemen. That's all right. In no discernible order, because I have no idea what's where. But we have to keep track of the company so many people are watching in the wake of the Iran's next, the Iraq war, and that's Halliburton, a company formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney. So two stories to keep you up to date on the Halliburton front. A subsidiary of Halliburton has earned nearly $90 million, catering to the Americans who are working to build Iraq, according to U.S. officials. While the reconstruction effort has yet to show results for Iraqis. This according to the Los Angeles Times runs news now? What the hell happened? What did I miss? I've been out of town. The Defense Department gave Halliburton's Kellogg Brown & Root subsidiary exclusive rights to the job, which has included fixing up an extravagant presidential palace being used by Americans under a broad Army logistics contract that pays the company a fee based on a percentage of everything it spends. That's a bad kind of contract. Take it from me. I'm in one of those. Under a task order from its lesser-known logistics contract, the Halliburton subsidiary has rung up a multi-million-dollar bill as the number of U.S. officials and Iraqi exiles working for the Pentagon created reconstruction agency balloons. In lengthy convoys from Kuwait, the company is hauling in everything from prefab offices and toilet blocks the size of caravans to food and bottled water. As supplies for Americans continue to arrive by the ton, little of the millions the Halliburton subsidiary is going to the Iraqi economy. It does not have a direct role in the rebuilding of the country. The company's most lucrative subcontracts are with transport, catering, and security companies based in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. So they're doing well. But lest you think that Halliburton is smart or anything, another subsidiary, no, same one, Kellogg Brown and Root, of Halliburton paid a Nigerian tax official $2.4 million in bribes to get favorable tax treatment. In a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the company said it made improper payments of approximately $2.5 million to an entity owned by a Nigerian official who held himself out as a tax consultant. In fact, he was an employee of the local tax authority. Yes, Halliburton fell for a Nigerian scam, ladies and gentlemen. It wasn't the letter from the widow of Mr. Seisi Seiko, or whatever his name is, or Abacha, but they fell for a Nigerian scam. The payments were found during a routine audit. Several employees were fired as a result. The bribes were paid between 2001 and 2002. Well, that would be between 2001 and 2002. That's right. Company officials are trying to determine how much the company owes Nigeria in back taxes. It could be as much as $5 million. So, maybe smart, maybe not smart, but in any case, even Halliburton gets scammed by the Nigerians. They're the number one scammers in the world. I mean, I'm not, that's not a characterization. It just happens. If you have email, you know this already. Ladies and gentlemen, you may recall Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, who was, I guess the Brits say it, sacked by this administration for his clumsiness, his awkwardness in being the front man for the administration's economic policy, especially the tax cut. So they replaced him with John Snow. And this weekend, with the war in abeyance at least, John Snow, the current Treasury Secretary, got to make his first real Sunday morning blitz on the Yak shows. And in trying to make the best case possible for the economic positive consequences of the administration's proposal to remove the dividend tax, here's what John Snow said in conversation with George Stephanopoulos.
Half of the households in America own equities.
Most of those households own equities through mutual funds or 401ks, and they're not going to get the full benefit of the dividend tax reduction.
Their net worth is going to go up. Their family wealth is going to go up. Their sense of well-being that's tied to the market will go up. You know, Americans follow the stock market today pretty much the way they follow their favorite baseball team and their box scores. The performance of the stock market is sort of a barometer on how we feel about the economy. So a stronger stock market helps us feel better about our economic circumstances.
So it's about feelings, ladies and gentlemen. It's all about feelings. You just look at those stock market figures and you feel richer. You may not be richer, but you feel. That's what it's all about. It's about feeling. So President Clinton felt our pain, and these guys are all about feeling too. I've emphasized the importance of this feature on the broadcast before. Never more than this week, however, ladies and gentlemen, burying the lead. Now, we've talked about news stories where the lead was buried, but how about just an entire story that should be the lead story being buried almost everywhere? It surfaced last Sunday in the Washington Post. It's been picked up by the BBC since then. And in a couple of other places, but you haven't seen it as the lead story on your major television news broadcasts or cable, because, you know, Lacey Peterson's case is moving along. Seven nuclear facilities in Iraq have been damaged or effectively destroyed by the looting that began in the first days of April when U.S. ground forces thrust into Baghdad, according to U.S. investigators and others with detailed knowledge of their work. The Bush administration fears that technical documents, sensitive equipment, and possibly radiation sources have been scattered. If so, there are potentially significant consequences for public health and the spread of materials to build a nuclear or radiological bomb. Was it the CIA covering their heinies before the war that said the best way to get the weapons of mass destruction either used or scattered was to attack? Well, they weren't used. But they may have been scattered. potentially deadly materials, this according to the Independent of Britain, potentially deadly materials have been among the loot taken from the Tuatha nuclear research plant in Iraq, where inspectors from the IAEA, or as George Bush calls it, the IEAE, had supervised the storage in a locked and guarded facility of tons of partly enriched uranium. Drums have been removed from the facility. Told about the drums, a senior official of the International Atomic Energy Agency said, "Our concerns about this site grow every day. The IAEA has been desperate to visit the site and has warned the U.S. since April 11th to take action to stop the looting." The agency is concerned about material falling into the hands of those seeking to create makeshift nuclear weapons. Washington has consistently refused to allow the IAEA inspectors in. Well known that Iraqi civilians are stripping much of this particular plant, Tuatha, of computers, furniture, refrigerators, timber, and sheets of metal. Also, these drums. Don't think of like bongos on the beach. These are, you know, storage drums. Discarded by looters who belatedly realized the dangers of what they were carrying and then taken into a school. Well, that's a good place for radioactive drums. Kids, play with these for a while. So why isn't that a major story, ladies and gentlemen? Instead, we have the story I'm just reaching. Don't worry about me. We have the story of President Bush landing on the aircraft carrier last week. Now, first of all, in that regard, a clarification from this broadcast. I said last week that no media were asking how come all the colored shirts on the deck of the aircraft carrier. Well, it turns out it's been a long time since I was on the deck of the USS Coral Sea, ladies and gentlemen, because now, and by the way, this turns out to be a record setter in terms of the number of Le Show listeners who responded with the correct answer. So, judging by my email, this audience knows more about uniform rules on United States aircraft carriers than about any other subject in the world. Congratulations, patriots. So here's the answer for those of you who don't know. In the new Navy, the colored jerseys are indicative of the particular jobs being held by the wearers, since it's a noisy and chaotic environment on the deck of an aircraft carrier. So blue is for, well, purple is for aviation fuels people. Blue is for plane handlers and tractor drivers. Green is for catapult and arresting gear crews, air wing maintenance personnel, and cargo handling personnel, as well as hook runners. Yellow is for aircraft handling officers and plane directors. Red is for ordnance men and explosive ordnance disposal. Brown is for air wing plane captains and air wing line leading petty officers. White is for air wing quality control personnel and squadron plane inspectors and medical personnel. So there's the color coding for you. But as I say, there's a lot of yak about the cost of the plane to fly Bush to President Bush to the aircraft carrier, the fact that the White House admits this week that they didn't really need to fly him in a plane that landed on the deck. They could have flown a copter. It wasn't that the carrier was so far out at sea. It was less than 30 miles from San Diego. And the couple of Democrats, the ones with the bad hair, you can tell when the Democrats are scared to talk about an issue because they bring out the guys with the bad hair, Henry Waxman and Senator Robert Byrd. The guys with the good hair won't talk about it, but they're criticizing President Bush for the tax money used in landing the plane on the aircraft carrier for the photo op speech, which just lets the Bush administration defenders say with some smirkiness, "Oh, the president landed on the with the wrong aircraft. Is that the best the Democrats could?" Now, ask yourself why, as long as they send out the guys with the bad hair, they don't send them out to say, "Well, here's the basic problem with this photo op. He's landing in this plane, acting as if this is what he does or what he ever did." And yet, if you examine President Bush's National Guard record, he was AWOL for a year, pretty much. Just didn't show up for his guard duty. The Chicago Tribune has reported this. But nobody else, and certainly the Democrats with the bad hair aren't talking about it. I wonder if they're scared. Just of their own whatever. I don't know, ladies and gentlemen. It's tough to tell these days what you're supposed to be scared of and what not. For example, Dateline London. The Fox News channel could be forced off the air in Britain. You didn't even know it was on the air in Britain. Yeah, if you have a satellite dish in Britain, you can get the Fox News channel. Reason enough. If an investigation currently underway by the watchdog Independent Television Commission determines that it violated the due impartiality rules during its coverage of the war in Iraq, as according to Britain's Guardian newspaper. The newspaper quotes Julian Petley, chairman of some campaign, is favoring action against the Rupert Murdoch-owned channel. There is a law in Britain that television stations have to have due impartiality in reporting the news. Those Brits and their quaint laws. The Washington Post reports that the group directing all known U.S. search efforts for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is winding down operations without finding proof that Hussein kept clandestine stocks of outlawed arms, according to participants. The 75th Exploitation Task Force has been described from the start as the principal component of the U.S. plan to discover and display forbidden Iraqi weapons. The group's departure, expected next month, marks a milestone in frustration for a major declared objective of the war. Scores of fruitless missions broke their confidence that they would find such weapons, according to many task force members in interviews. Said Army Colonel Richard McPhee, who will close down the task force next month, "We didn't have all those people in protective suits for nothing, but if Iraq thought of using such weapons, there had to have been something to use, and we haven't found it. Books will be written on that in the intelligence community for a long time." Another newspaper puts it even more starkly. The Glasgow Sunday Herald quotes senior officials in the Bush administration as admitting they would be amazed if weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq. That's a quote, the word amazed. According to administration sources, Saddam shut down and destroyed large parts of his weapons of mass destruction programs before the invasion of Iraq. Amazed! What else at the top of the news from the rear? Probably just this account from a British newspaper which opposed the war, the Independent. Comparing what we said before and what we're doing now. On oil, Tony Blair, I emphasized this quote to you several times. Tony Blair said in promising that Iraq's oil would be put, the funds, monies from Iraq's oil would be put in a UN trust fund. Quote, "We don't touch it and the U.S. doesn't touch it." That's what he said on MTV on March 7th. Actually, on Friday, the U.S. and Britain introduced a draft U.N. resolution giving total control of Iraq's oil revenues to the United States and Britain. Well, that's just a minor. George W. Bush said on April 8th in Belfast, Northern Ireland, the U.N. will have a vital role to play in a post-war Iraq. Nope. British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw on the 25th of April asked himself, should the UN have a vital role to play in respect of weapons inspections? The answer to that is yes in a post-war Iraq. The answer to that, in fact, is no for the foreseeable future. And this week, in that UN resolution, the United States and Britain, for the first time, called themselves occupying powers, which is a change from liberating forces, which was the original description. But that's, you know, that's just verbiage, ladies and gentlemen. And now it's time for our regular weekly feature, the Apologies of the Week.
We're so sorry.
First, a non-apology from Turkey. Turkish officials today dismissed critical remarks by Paul Wolfowitz, suggesting that the country had made a mistake by not opening its doors to the American military during the Iraq War. Says Prime Minister Erdogan, Turkey, from the very beginning, never made any mistakes and has taken all the necessary steps in all sincerity. That, ladies and gentlemen, that's a textbook non-apology. Never made any mistakes. The great Sasuke, a pro wrestler who was elected in April to an assembly seat in northeastern Japan, has apologized for coming to his job with his wrestling mask on. That's an idea for Jesse Ventura on that long-delayed MSNBC show. Where's mask? He offered an apology to voters for the issue of my mask causing such problems. The great Sasuke apologizes. In Massachusetts, House Speaker Thomas Finneran has issued an unusual public apology to Governor Mitt Romney, saying his recent criticisms of the governor were harsher and more personal than warranted. He told a morning radio audience that a scathing letter he sent to the governor included language that was uncalled for. In the letter, he blasted Romney for polarizing issues and relying on simplistic PowerPoint presentations and press releases. Jason Blair, the New York Times reporter who was fired for plagiarizing an account of an interview with the parents of a dead soldier, has apologized to executive editor Howell Raines at the New York Times for a lapse in journalistic integrity and saying he was seeking appropriate counseling. He did not return a call to his cell phone yesterday. There's been a lot of talk about this Jason Blair story, 50 corrections issued over the 3 years that he was writing for the Times. Kind of outrageous. But here's, talk about burying the lead. Here's something I saw in one story that I didn't see anywhere else. He was not available. Some reporter tried to call him on his cell phone. Quote, Blair vacated his last registered address, an apartment in Brooklyn, several months ago, leaving behind what was described as structural damage and extensive filth that caused several thousand dollars to undo. Unquote. I knew journalists were sloppy, but extensive filth. The Boston Globe suspended sports columnist Bob Ryan for 1 month without pay because of inappropriate remarks he made on a sports final show. His comments were a clear and egregious violation of the standards of the Boston Globe. And Ryan has apologized. During a discussion with host Bob Lobel, this is Ryan's statement, on the subject of fan sportsmanship, I hyperbolically stated that Jason Kidd's wife, who had claimed fan harassment in the Fleet Center during last year's playoff series, should be smacked for her general behavior. It was, of course, atrocious judgment on my part. I wish to state clearly above them. I hereby apologize to Globe readers and WBZ viewers. You have a month to think about that. From the Idaho Statesman, a headline on the front page last Saturday about a Colorado climber who amputated his own arm was insensitive. In trying to reflect his personality and sense of adventure, it said, quote, with guts like this, who needs two arms? Unquote. We apologize. And Oklahoma Governor Brad Henry has apologized to anyone who was offended by a speech in which he called for more lawyers in the Oklahoma legislature. The apologies of the week, it's a copyrighted feature. Why would you even try to imitate it?
chicken, don't want beef, don't need no meat between my teeth. I want a bean burrito with black beans and rice. Well, in my travels around the world, I've sampled haute cuisine, European specialties like souffle de tangerine. Well, I've had soul food, greasy chopped and barbecued hog maws. But there's one dish I'd really love to eat more than them all. I want a bean burrito with black beans and rice. I want till it hurts. And there's a time for soup and sushi. And even though I don't like sauerkraut, there's something else that really knocks me out.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Book Bag. Book Bag, chit and chat about the fascinating world between the table of contents and the index. I'm Ira Zipkin. We've had many embarrassments on this program. One thinks of the week that Gore Vidal recited two stanzas of his love poem to Timothy McVeigh. But this week our embarrassment is one of riches, since we have not one but two guests, each of whom has authored an important new book. Each. Robert Bloom is an old friend of the book bag, if indeed bags can have friends, the baseball editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and author of more volumes of elegiac prose about the national pastime than seem remotely possible. His latest is called A Hitch in the Delivery. And Jonathan Dreidelman is an important cog in the neoconservative machine, a thinker in residence at the Murdoch Institute, and himself the author of an imposing new book, one could almost call it an impose, called The View from the Eagle's Nest. Gentlemen, welcome to the book bag. And Robert Bloom, let's begin with you. A Hitch in the Delivery, I'm guessing, is not about pitchers.
No, Ira, and it's not about pregnant female baseball writers either.
Well, that does leave us with the rather plaintive question of what the book is about.
Ira, as you know, a couple of very significant baseball franchises in Southern California have been put up for sale.
The Dodgers and the Angels.
That's correct. I spent the off-season in both front offices watching the way the game of selling a major league team is played. It's a game with its own rules.
And nobody's yelling, kill the umpire.
I guess you could say that. So I wanted to write a book that captured the sweet sadness, the bittersweet hope of a baseball team where the metaphorical catcher is flashing only one sign, the for sale sign.
I'm captivated already. Did you write about the Dodgers or the Angels?
Interesting question, Ira. I decided that I wanted to spread my wings a little bit with this work, so I combined observations from both teams into the story of a fictional team I call the Los Angeles Amigos. It's owned by a large company, the Maximus Corporation, and the company realizes, as the book begins, that the splendid frustration of owning a major league franchise is not conducive to a 35% profit margin.
Are they in the National or American League?
The Amigos? It's left up to the reader to imagine that detail. But what I've tried to do, Ira, is to capture that springtime moment when life seems possible again in all its innocence and hope, when it seems that the sale might actually be consummated.
Springtime moment, then, is a metaphor. You're not talking about the actual springtime of the year.
In this case, no.
Well, we'll hear you read from A Hitch in the Delivery in just a moment, but I want to turn to our other guest right now, since he's been spending the last 5 minutes looking at the back of my head. Jonathan Dreidelman, you come naturally to the worlds of politics and ideas, of ideas about politics as well as the politics of ideas.
I guess you could say that, Ira.
You're the son of the influential Trotskyite writer and polemicist of the 1950s and 60s, Seymour Allen Dreidelman.
Yes, and then, of course, he became a Maoist in the late 60s, so, well, you've heard of red diaper babies. I was a Mao-suited teenager, very bizarre. I wore the same jacket for all 3 years of high school and to my prom.
Blue?
Well, I wasn't invited to very many parties.
No, I meant that was the familiar blue Mao jacket that so many of us affected back then.
That's correct.
And your ideological journey since then has been, I guess it's safe to say, quick and far.
In a way, yes, of course, since I became an adamant champion of free enterprise, an advocate of limited government, and along the way, something of a fashion plate at any given moment, I own more than 100 Hugo Boss suits.
Suppose if that prom ever comes by again, you'll be ready. But in your new book, The View from the Eagle's Nest, you seem to be retracing some of those steps. First of all, the title. Are you referring to the elevated point of view from high on a ship's mast?
No. I'm referring very specifically to the view that America has of the rest of the world at this very significant moment. I call it a turning point in world history.
America being the eagle.
Yes, that's right.
And the nest being where America sits. And the retracing of your steps has something to do with that view.
Well, Ira, when I was young and rejecting Marxism, it seemed particularly absurd to hear my father's friends and colleagues referring to American imperialism. You know, it just seemed such a ludicrous concept on its face. This was a democratic republic. On the rare occasions when we subdued countries in the past, the Philippines or Cuba, we did so only in order to free them. That's not the way empires behaved. But in a post-Soviet world, we are the empire. That's not our idea. That's history's. And so, like it or not, we have to assume the mantle of empire and make it work for us.
An interviewer said your thesis might be summed up as, when you're Rome, do as the Romans do.
Well, that's a very silly and almost childlike formulation, but it's essentially correct. At the end of the day, more properly at the end of this historical period, however long it lasts, hopefully several hundred years, people are not going to ask how nice America was. They're going to ask how well it fulfilled its imperial responsibilities. And to say we sat in the corner and rejected them is to say that we were the cop who slept in the station house while the 9/11 call went unanswered.
This is assuming they have 9/11 calls in the future.
Yes, that's right.
We hear so much about the influence the neoconservatives have on this White House. Has the president read your book?
Yes, as a matter of fact, he has, Ira. I'm proud to say I got a note from him just last week. He just finished my chapter on the lessons of Byzantium.
Well, without giving away confidences, can you tell us what he said in the note?
He said he found it very instructive, and he added in jest that he used to think Byzantium was some kind of hair tonic.
Some would wonder whether it was in jest.
I think that some would wonder that are beneath intellectual contempt.
Jonathan Jadelman, just one of your controversial notions in The View from the Eagle's Nest, you suggest a new way to make America independent of Mideast oil.
That's correct. So-called energy independence schemes are basically just a way to get the federal government into the business of making us sell our Hummers. We're dependent on Mideast oil because that's the region where we currently have large numbers of troops stabilizing the situation. That gives some very unsavory nations too much leverage over us. If we balance things out by having large numbers of troops stationed anywhere in the world where there are serious oil reserves, the Middle East will shrivel in importance as a natural process without the American people having to buy one single bicycle.
Well, all I know is the saddle hurts my seat. Robert Bloom, take us back to the Men of Winter in a reading from your book, A Hitch in the Delivery.
Okay, Ira, this is midway through the negotiations to sell the team to a New York sports executive. The sky darkened to a gloomy symphony of grays. The flag out in Amigo Stadium center field whipped around in the stiff onshore wind. A hyperactive fraternal twin to its somnolent summertime self. Peter Quinn paced in his office as if counting off feet from third to home in a long-ago playground. The phone rang, a shrill signal, a play ball of the soul, that the negotiating game was about to begin. Quinn was a TV man, not a baseball man. His idea of a big ballpark promotion was Jim Belushi night at the end of July. But in the 8 months since he took the job, he'd inhaled the smells of the game, the infield grass newly cut, the concession sushi in the bottom of the eighth, the locker room after the visiting team is gone. So he was preparing to take an outrageous position and ask for too much money for the team. He was, he realized later, about to strike out on balls.
Strike out on balls. What an ironic metaphor of futility.
Well, it's actually a metaphor of over-testosterone behavior. Balls, as...
Gotcha. Always room for another entendre, but unfortunately, no time for further badinage. Robert Bloom, Jonathan Dreidelman, thank you for proving that where fascinating authors are concerned, two really are as good as one. Next time, more about life between the bindings. For now, I'm Ira Zipkin, climbing out. of the Book Bank. Funding for this program came from Borders Without Doctors, the bookstore chain that sounds like a charity. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Come on, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, gotta get her out of there.
Come on, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, mama says it just ain't fair.
One night, mama went to fetch us up, a sweet potato fell down the cellar stairs.
Stork dropped in while she was on the floor, so my sister was born down there.
Daddy said, listen, won't be nothing but a misery, never will be worth a damn.
But mama just loved her little sweet potato baby with a face like a parboiled yam.
Come on, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, gotta get her out of there. Come on, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, mama says it just ain't fair.
Potato grew up to be as pretty as a peach in her calico and honey yellow curls.
Went to the apple cider ball at the armory with all the other ripe and ready girls.
Sheriff and Pike picked potato for the polka, but she's burning with a fiddly dee.
And before she could turn around and find another partner, Sheriff took her into custody.
Come on, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, gotta get her out of there. Come on, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, mama says it just ain't fair.
Mom and Daddy put together quite a little posse, counting me and Jack and Cousin Will.
We all hopped into the old Chevy pickup and we caught him at the top of the hill.
Daddy took his Remington and shot away the lock door to set his little darling free.
But Potato said,
Daddy shut the golden door, Sheriff wants to marry me.
Let's go, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, guess we better leave her there. Let's go, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, Mama says it's more than fair. Let's go, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, guess we better leave her there. Let's go, boys, potatoes in the paddy wagon, Mama says it's more than fair. Mama says it's more than fair. Mama says it's more than fair.
Ladies and gentlemen, a story broke this week that Aaron Brown of CNN, as well as Morley Safer of CBS and Walter Cronkite, formerly of CBS, have been getting money for doing some work for WJMK Incorporated, a Florida-based company that provides television stations, mainly public TV stations, with video segments on healthcare or drug companies. The article originally in the New York Times last Wednesday asked whether the men were being paid to help produce commercials that seemed like news. Safer stood in a news-style set to record general introductions to segments. In one video where Safer appeared, drug company executives promoted their experimental antidepressant, nimifetide. Government recently ordered a stop to human trials of the drug because a study showed it was toxic to beagles, according to the Times. Safer believed the job would meet CBS news standards because he was told the segments were being made for PBS, which is non-commercial. After he saw how the work was used, he realized it did not conform with CBS standards and has not appeared before a camera for them since. Spokesman for WJMK did not immediately return phone calls for comment. CNN had given Aaron Brown the okay to film the messages this past winter. CNN was told the messages would be independent news vignettes for PBS stations and that Brown would have editorial oversight. Based on information we recently learned, said a CNN spokeswoman, WJMK is not sufficiently independent to satisfy the editorial standards of CNN or Brown. Other news of the media. Ratings for the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather plummeted to one of the broadcast's least watch weeks ever, pulling in less than 7 million viewers. CBS News officials could not point to any one reason. Industry officials attributed the ratings drop, according to the New York Post, to an editorial decision to focus less on Iraq and more on SARS. At the same time, CBS News President Andrew Hayward told a group of media executives that the big three evening news broadcasts are uncannily similar, and he said, I'm not proud of it. The key to success, Hayward said, is differentiation, but that the only major TV news organization to actually pull that off is the Fox News Channel, co-owned with the New York Post. Gosh, it sounds like a another bad day at Black Rock. Next here on the show.
So, Dan, just to make sure that we understand
what it is I'm saying. Mm-hmm. We want to differentiate the evening news from the competition. No two ways about it. But yes, we don't want to be so different that we scare away half the audience.
So you're talking about a difference that's as subtle as an armadillo's smile.
I guess I am, although I must admit I wouldn't know an armadillo from from any other kind of anteater.
So you're saying, sir, if I read you correctly, don't do a different lead story, but
maybe take your commercial breaks at a different spot. You know, everybody breaks at the same time. That's a product advantage we could exploit if we had it.
So take our breaks later. Make our early stories longer and our later stories shorter.
Or vice versa. Look, if I knew how to run a newscast, Daniel, I wouldn't be president of the news division, would I?
No.
That's for you and your people to work out. I just don't think we can afford too many more weeks under 7 million viewers without the fearless leaders upstairs wondering whether we shouldn't just give up the evening news business and focus on the 60 minutes and 48 hours businesses.
Brother Hayward, we've heard these threats for at least 20 years that the evening news days are numbered and its nights are shorter than a midget's pinky. We've always hung in there, we've always survived, and we've never had to give up more than insignificant slivers of our soul to do it. So
this time, this isn't Brother Tish breathing down our necks during the few moments each week when he focuses on the network. We're dealing with serious people now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Well, Ed Murrow dealt with serious people. Bill Paley was slaughterhouse serious.
And the people we're dealing with now, when they think about great broadcasters, they think Carson Daly, not Ed Murrow. You see what I'm saying? I didn't let you go gray so that we could lose the franchise, Brother Rather.
All right, Brother Hayward. Message received. Pimpmobile loud and Kirstie Alley clear. It'll be different, but just different enough. No way I want to see what Brown can do for me again. Take care, sir. You're making us all prouder than a new mama prairie dog.
My door is always open, Daniel.
Yes, sir. Of course, new mama prairie dog tries to eat her pups, but I'll see you in five, gentlemen. I'm going on a Snapple Chino break. Hey, sir, please, why don't you...
Daniel.
Brother Brown.
I'm sorry, I was walking fast even for New York. I'm late for a meeting at my lawyer's office.
Well, no problem, Aaron. You're just a cable anchor I wanted to talk to.
Really?
Yes, sir. Phone pole straight and first love true. You're kicking serious business end on your broadcast, sir. You're making me proud to be a colleague of yours.
Well, Daniel, I'm just doing a little cable show. You're still speaking to... What is it now? Almost twice as many viewers as
I... You know,
let
me answer the question that's in both our minds. What can Brother Brown do for me? What a cooler word has it, sir, that you're doing these informational vignettes about medical news for public television stations, which goodness knows could use some network polish.
Yeah.
And that you're taking home a pretty darn nice piece of change in the process.
Well,
here we go.
Daniel, thanks. I wasn't going to...
Come on, I'll buy you a latte. Hello. A grande latte and a double espresso for here.
Yes, that's $2.75.
There you go. Thank you. Keep this much of the change.
All right.
Daniel, it is difficult to wrap our arms around the whole of this idea, but it appears that Brother Safer and Brother Cronkite and I were being used to front infomercials for the pharmaceutical companies. We've all quit the project. A headline, please. Anchors away.
That's good. That's very good. You remind me of a middle-aged me. Whip smart and still scared stallion frisky. Hello, Kosh. Obviously, if you all have vacated the premises, these people may just be in the mood to pay top dollar for evening news quality piece of talent.
Grande latte, double espresso.
Thanks, Daniel. Look, this is hard for me to say, but there's a bad smell to this thing.
Well, it's no Starbucks, but...
I mean this deal. Mm. You don't need this. You've got a legacy to protect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Have you tried to get a bank to take your legacy as collateral on a boat loan?
No, sir, I have not.
Didn't think so. Look, Oz, if your people are still on chatting terms with these folks, just let them know that Brother Dan might at least be willing to pick up the phone and visit with them.
Yeah, it is difficult to know when we'll talk again.
Excuse me, miss. I asked for a double espresso for here.
We don't got no clean cups.
I'll see you later, brother.
Yes, sir. Excuse me, please, yeah. But I'm here every day. You never have any clean cups.
We don't got no cups.
I see. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. I got to go plan for the new Iraq. The program returns, somebody's got to do it. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, on the great shortwave transmitter up and down the east coast of WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, across North America via Sirius satellite radio, and around the world on the internet at two locations, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And it would be just like the new Iraq coming to fruition if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. The show Internet Services by Steve Mack. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.